accession number 28642, Reel 2.
You mentioned that you weren't interested in joining up, but obviously there was a point where you decided to. What was that?
The point was the evacuation from Dunkirk. You couldn't ignore that. There was a demonstration that the war was going very badly for us. Up until that time, I had confidence that we'd seen keep the Germans at bay, but it happened very quickly. Because when the war started, there was very, not much action for a long time.
So Dunkirk is the turning point for you.
It was.
What happened? What do you recall of hearing about Dunkirk?
Well, we used to listen on the radio in the common room at the university on the war reports, and it became a topic among the engineering students who were in third year at that time of a five-year course. And a few of them were already in the Army Reserve, and they said, we've got to front up for this. We've got to join the Army. And I had a friend there called Peter Taylor, and he was interested in the Navy, and so was I. And so we decided we would go down to the Navy depot in Fremantle and offer our services. So we did that, and a lieutenant commander, who was a recruiting officer, and he said, look, I could take you on as stokers, but you're 60% through your engineering course. Go back and finish, and then come back, and you can come in as engineering officers, and that'll be far better for you and far better for the Navy. So we went back to university. We didn't want to hear that, but all the same, we did as he said. It wasn't long after that an advertisement appeared in the West Australian calling for volunteers with yachting experience to be trained in the Navy as anti-submarine officers. So Peter and I hot-footed it down to Lewin again and got application forms and filed them, and we were interviewed and tests went on and so on, and we were luckily both accepted. And that was a bit of good luck, because we found out that there are 260 applications in Fremantle, and they took in six people, and we were two of them. And I think the fact that we were halfway through an engineering course put us in a good position, because we'd studied the basic sciences like physics and chemistry and mechanics and hydraulics and so on, and this is very useful aboard ship. In fact, I found it extremely useful throughout the war that I'd completed third year by the time we were mobilised, and I had no bother, especially when I joined submarines, in understanding how they worked, because they are machines. They employ all of the scientific principles. And so it was October in 1940 when we found ourselves in uniform, and my parents were a bit dismayed. My father wasn't enthusiastic, but he had to, I think, sign an agreement for me to join the Navy, which he did. My mother wasn't too happy, but we could see that we were under threat, and when you're under threat, if you don't do something about it, you go under. And I believe now it was, for me, it was the right decision. I've never regretted having done it.
So let's talk then about joining up. What was involved, and the initial stages of?
The initial step was to drive down to it was then HMAS Lewin in Cliff Street in Fremantle, and knock on the door of the recruiting office and go in and say, we've come in response to this advertisement in the paper, and they said, well, here's some application forms. So we filled in the forms and left them, and in the course of time, might have been a week or two, we were called down for interview, and then we were given a series of tests. And I can remember the tests. Some of them were tests of logic. The Battle of the River Plate had just taken place, and that was big news, of course. And one of the questions was, on this piece of paper there's a line, a horizontal line, that represents a ship. If the Graff's Bay was sunk in the Battle of the River Plate, draw two funnels on the ship and one mast. If it was not sunk, then put one funnel and two masts. And there were a lot of questions like that. That was a pretty easy one. Some of them were a bit tricky. You had to think pretty hard. But we did that test, and I've done a few tests like that since. I think they're probably designed by professional psychologists or something, endeavouring to find out how clever you were. I'm not too sure whether it worked, but anyway, it got us into the Navy. And there were a lot of questions about the Navy. And during the interview, of course, the Navy were always very interested in hereditary and what your great-grandfather did. Well, I didn't know then, but I found out since, that my great-great-great-great uncle in the 1700s was a smuggler out of Weymouth in England. Now, if I'd have come out with that, I'd have been right in, because that's right up the Navy's line. But I didn't know that, but I was telling my father that night that they asked me if I had any seafaring ancestors. I said, oh, yes, of course. My grandfather was in square riggers bringing horses from Madagascar to Fremantle. And your father said, well, you're very nearly right. Your grandfather, certainly in the horse trade with Madagascar, but he never left Australia. Somebody else brought the horses across, but it didn't matter. I was in. I had no great history in the family to draw on to put up my chances of getting in. So I was really scraping it for whatever I could get. But it seemed to work because I got in. And I think the way it turned out, it wasn't the biggest mistake the Navy ever made, because I did a few stupid things in the Navy, but I got a few things right. And I think what mattered most of all is that I was very enthusiastic about it, and my loyalty was never in doubt. And that's not always the case with people. I met, as I went along, some people that were in the Navy, but they didn't care a great deal about it. But I did. I cared a good deal about it. And having had some engineering training at university, I always studied fairly hard at whatever was presented to us, because I knew that if you wanted to succeed, you had to understand what you were doing. And I did that. I found our Navy training, I thought, was good. It probably could have been better, because I was a civilian first in the Navy, and you were enthusiastic about everything. Later on, you find out that some of the training could have been better, but that's life, isn't it? You could always do something better the second time. Of course, it was the thing at the time to be in uniform. I got a white feather during all this. They were flying around in those days, not on birds, in envelopes. And I don't know who said it, but I'd already started negotiations with the Navy to join when I got this thing. It's a stupid practice, because you don't know the other person's point of view. And I was doing my damnedest to get in, and being criticised by somebody for not being in it.
Well, people blame each other for not hearing the bugle early enough and all that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But my impression is that is a slightly more jovial attitude.
Yeah, yes.
To what degree were people looking for adventure in joining up?
Oh, well, to a pretty high degree, I think. Because my friend Peter Taylor was not a good student. He's a good engineer, as he came out, but he wasn't an academic by any means. And he, part of getting into the Navy would be to dodge the third year final examinations. And third year was the two-term year, so it finished early. And the Navy took so long to mobilise us that the exams came first. And but Peter, as soon as he was accepted for the Navy, took a long time to be mobilised, you know, a few weeks. he stopped studying. But I'm always a bit of a pessimist. I wouldn't depend ever on that, being able to dodge exams. You know, they were going to come. They were inevitable. So I kept studying the best I could. But Peter, adventure was the name of the game.
Being involved in the Navy. Now, that was, you were definitely going to see some parts of the world there.
Yeah, yes. Oh, that's right. Yes. Well, then some of the relatives started to contribute. We had one uncle, his name was Charlie Sheen. He's a fairly distant uncle. I'm not too sure where I have drawn a family tree, and I'll show it on that, but I can't remember what it was. But his roots came from England. A few must have migrated several generations back. Well, he had a lot of relatives in England. He was a religious crank. He was a Plymouth Brethren, and he was so strict, the things he wouldn't do on Sunday and so on. And we didn't particularly like him, because he's always criticising my father for not sending us to church every Sunday and so on. And I didn't want to go to church every Sunday. But he gave me a list of his relatives around London. And when I got there, I did chase a few of them up. But I found they weren't interested in me. In fact, I used to write back to my sister, my younger sister, and tell her who I met and where they fitted in with the family. Because I wrote to her, because the whole family read the letter. But she wrote back and said, my father said that he is Harry Sheen. He doesn't give a damn about the rest of them. So I stopped visiting the relatives then. I thought, he wasn't interested in his ancestors. Well, I suppose I wasn't either. And I had other things to do with my runs ashore than visit relatives. But some of them were quite nice. I think I only visited about three lots. I found more sense that they're really quite interesting people. One who lives in Yorkshire, and he was involved with power generation, which was my profession after the war. So I found he's quite a good chap.
Let's talk then about really getting stuck in, and obviously you were to join up. When was it that you were full-time, properly mobilised into the Navy?
28th of October 1940. That's a very significant day, because that sets your seniority in the Navy. And when you get a group of people together, they're all of the same rank, it comes to the date of your attaining that rank. And that establishes the pecking order, which is absolute. Nothing else matters. Whether you're clever or dumb, doesn't matter. If somebody is... in fact, we were 12 of us mobilised on the one day to go through the anti-submarine school in Sydney, in Victoria, and then in New South Wales. And as we were all mobilised on the one day, the senior person was Adams, because he started with A. Sheen was just about junior the whole lot, on the end of the alphabet. That's always the case in the Navy. They have a Navy list, which lists every officer in the Navy. And when you come across another ship at sea, it's very important to know which has the senior captain. So you look up the Navy list, and if the other ship has got a senior captain to your ship, well, then he's in charge. Yeah, I suppose they've got to have some system, and that's the way it is. So, of course, the day you join, you've got no seniority, whatever. You're the lowest form of marine growth, they called us. We were sub-lieutenants, temporary acting on probation, Royal Australian Navy, Volunteer Reserve, and there's no form of marine life any lower than that. So gradually you claw your way up the ship side. But in the long run, it doesn't matter very much.
What was known about submarines? I mean,
what was known about them?
What was their reputation?
Well, we knew the U-boats were pretty efficient, and they were rendering havoc among the Allied merchant fleet. The Germans are very good at that way. They're not like the British. They really, from a technical point of view, they deserve to win. But technical considerations aren't the only considerations. But the most popular U-boat was the Type 7C, and Dönitz was the German admiral, and he'd served in the Great War in a very similar submarine. And when the Second World War broke out and he was in charge of the submarine arm, he had these submarines replicated, and they built about 700 of them. And no navy has ever built that many of one class of ship. But his belief was that with submarines he could win the war, and he jolly nearly did too. And by the time I joined the Navy, it was well known that the U-boats were very efficient, very effective. And to join the anti-submarine service of the Navy was a very important role, although we felt that we weren't terribly well equipped to find and sink submarines. The Navy had the Royal Navy had developed what's now called sonar, was then called ASDIC, which is echo detection. Of course, it's advanced a lot since those days, but Admiralty had great faith in it, more faith than they should have had, because during our training, we just learned about this equipment. It was terribly secret, and it was largely electronic, and it was so secret we weren't allowed to take notes. We had to remember everything, the circuits and so on. And we had a chief petty officer instructing us, a chap called Beer, chief petty officer Beer, and he was a very good instructor, a very good lecturer. He was absolutely practical. And the last lecture he gave us, he said, "Now you've learned a lot about the ASDIC, and you've got a lot of faith in it." He said, "I can tell you, you probably will never succeed in killing a submarine." He said, "You probably won't even contact a submarine. They're there, they're sinking ships right and left, but don't think that you're going to find every submarine, because you won't." And he was absolutely right. The chances of success were nothing like 100%. They might have been 10%. We worked very hard at it. But then, of course, the ASIC wasn't everything. I've done a lot of thinking about this since. I spent 15 months chasing submarines around the Atlantic, and our successes weren't great, but they were, as it turned out, they were sufficient, only just. Because now you've got the advantage of hindsight, and you've got so much published information and statistical information, because you haven't got that at the time, because it hasn't happened yet. But the most convincing set of statistics I've come across is a graph showing the number of ships sunk each month by U-boats, and the number of U-boats sunk by the Royal Navy and other navies. And you can see month by month throughout the war, there's progression. We are getting better. In the beginning, one U-boat would sink about 10 British ships. But by May 1943, it came to 1 and 1. And when that happened, Dönitz said, "Don't attack British convoys. It's not worth it." So in that time, from 1940 to 1943, we'd overcome this tremendous disadvantage. Now, I was only in it until September 42, and then I joined submarines. It wasn't on the scheme, if you can't beat it, join it. It was just that the Admiralty called for volunteers, and a little bit of salesmanship, they get enough volunteers.
Mm. Well, before we get to that point, I wanted to know how one learns to supposedly sink submarines before they've actually experienced a submarine.
Yes, well, that applies to...
How do you train someone to blow up a submarine?
Yeah. That applies more to fighter aircraft than to submarines. Oh. Because with fighter aircraft, if you don't shoot the other aircraft down, you get shot down yourself. And they reckon until a new pilot has shot down 5 enemy aircraft, he can't be sure of survival. After that, then he's fairly reliable. But with the submarines, it's not quite that bad. But how do you do it? Well, the first thing we did when we had training, after a month at Flinders Naval Depot in Victoria, when you learn about all aspects of the Navy, like Navy organisation, about gunnery, torpedoes, and navigation, and everything else, then you said to Sydney, we would go to an anti-submarine school which specialises on submarine detection. And there you study this ASDIC thing, learn the circuits, and they had quite a good simulator there. So without going to sea, you go onto an attack table where they got in one room they've got a mock-up of a binnacle, a steering wheel, and windows where you can look out with binoculars and so on. And in the next room is an electrical device, which is a model of the ocean, and is a model of your ship, and your ASDIC beam is a model of a U-boat. And in the first room, which is the ship's bridge, you're steaming on a course and at a speed, and you're doing an ASDIC sweep, which means that the fellow who's operating this ASDIC has got headphones on, and he's got an automatic device down below that gives ping, 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 and it sends out a transmission, and then it switches to receive, and it gets the echo back if you're in contact with the submarine. So your ASDIC operator is there, and of course the person running the session sets it up, so you're going to intercept a submarine. He puts a submarine on the attack table where you are heading, and so the first thing you know is the ASDIC operator says contact bearing, whatever it is bearing, and gives the range and bearing. So from there on, you start an attack, and you alter the ship's course and increase speed. You alert the depth charge crews that you're attacking, and to set depth charges to a certain depth. It might be 50 feet, and a pattern of 5 depth charges. That is 3 over the stern and throwers each side. So you drive a pattern like that with a submarine in the middle, you hope. And all this is very realistic, because while you're doing this, there's a few people creating diversions, saying it's a torpedo approaching and so on, and there's an enemy ship firing a 15-inch gun at you and so on, just to make it pretty difficult for you. But it was very good exercise, apart from the diversions, because if you do the attack right, you're credited with a sinking. And that was a very good tool for practicing without a submarine. And that's all we got in Australia. We didn't have any submarines to practice with. So having spent 4 months at that school, we only had probably one or two runs each on the attack teacher, which isn't nearly enough. We should have been on it day after day for weeks. So then off we went in a merchant ship for England, and I was appointed to HMS Bluebell, a corvette, ship designed as submarine, anti-submarine escort vessels, and we were allocated convoys between Liverpool and Gibraltar.
What was it like to realise, okay, now I'm off,
yeah.
Here we go?
Yeah, well, it's very exciting and a little bit frightening, because you wonder whether you're able, whether you're sufficiently trained. I was worried about being sunk. That didn't seem to be a concern. But whether I could do the job properly. We know we had not enough training. Theoretically, we were right up with it. We could draw these circuits from memory quite well. As a matter of fact, Chap Beer had a very good technique. One day, he gave us a lecture on, in case we were pointed to a destroyer, the oscillator, which is what sends the signal and gets it back, they call it transducers also, was in a dome protruding from the bottom of the keel of a ship. And this is streamlined, so that as a ship is travelling at, say, 15 or 20 knots, there's not too much water noise, as you can hear the signal coming back. Well, then a destroyer, which can go up to 35 knots, they had to retract the dome. Had to put it back into the ship, otherwise it would be damaged by the speed. And one day we were given the circuit for lowering and raising the dome. And that was a pretty complicated circuit. And Bill Beer put it up on the board. He said, right, you're going to learn that before lunchtime. He said, you'll put threepence, which is a lot of money, in the kitty. And after lunch, you'll draw it from memory. And the one who gets it most correct gets the kitty. Boy, did we work hard. Didn't have any lunch. We went off and drew the thing from memory and said, is that right? No, that's not right. That's the wrong stuff. And when we came back, he set the competition off, and I got it right. But when we went back, he said, now, draw the circuit for lowering it, destroys set to lower. So I did the circuit, but being a bit slow, I drew the circuit as per the morning instruction, which was everything in neutral, all switches open. But one of them, a chap called Mitchell, South Australia, an engineering student, he got it right. He had his switches set to lower, which was the critical point. So he was better than I was. But I'm not too sure whether he survived the war. I can't find him now. But that made us learn. And that was a very good technique. So when we got to England, we found, as we met other anti-submarine officers, that the course we had been given in Australia was pretty good. And quite a few of our people became flotilla submarine, anti-submarine officers. In fact, I met one on this mission to France. He spent all his time on anti-submarine work, whereas I joined submarines. But the training was good, but it's still not enough. At the end of the war, I think I was trained enough to be at the beginning of the war. But that was 5 years later. There's so much to learn, so much experience to get, that you don't get it all in the classroom. They do their best, and I couldn't do any better. But you really want a long time at it. That's why it's probably good to join the reserve. So you're not in peacetime, and you're learning for a long time. So when the national emergency arises, you're already part-trained. You've still got a hell of a lot to learn when you get to sea, but at least you're some of the way there. I was probably no distance of the way there, and I did some pretty stupid things. I cringe with shame when I think of some of the things I did. It wasn't very good.
So the trip away, here we are, was heading off. What was it like to be seeing the world?
That was good. There's no denying adventure is a big part of serving in any service. I liked being in England. Once I got used to it, when I arrived was sent to my first ship, I hated it for the first couple of weeks. I was homesick, I was seasick, and those two don't go too well together. I used to go and watch on the bridge in a long oilskin coat, the oilskin sou'wester with a bucket. And because it's very hard to hold up your dignity as an officer when you go up there with a bucket in your hand. Because you feel a damn fool. But I suppose we're all fools in a way. And everybody's been through it. And after a while, you live that down. And when I left the ship 15 months later, I felt as I was leaving home. And I felt sort of homesick again. So in 15 months, you get over the first difficulty and you feel a place. Also, by that time, I'd achieved acceptance, I think, even with the captain. The captain told me after the war that I was the first Australian he'd ever sailed with. And he had no faith in me, whatever, quite rightly, because I was green as grass. But at least I was trying. I know now that he didn't give me a very good break, because I think I can work out how it happened now. You learn, you think back on things. Our first outward trip to Gibraltar was a dream run. No U-boats. We got there, didn't lose any ships. On the way back, it was a change altogether. We were contacted by U-boats and we lost a lot of ships. And it was always at night, and that's not very pleasant. If you're going to the middle watch, which I always had, it was from midnight to 4 a.m., it's the graveyard, what they call it. You turn in as soon as you had your supper and get a bit of sleep. And then you get waking at 20 to 12, go on the bridge, come down after 4 o'clock and try and get a bit more sleep. Well, while you're having your pre-midnight sleep is when the U-boats attack and you hear an explosion and you think, oh, crumbs. And 10 seconds later, the alarm bell rings, action stations. So you're always sleeping in your clothes. Turn out of your bunk, put on your oilskin, because it's always wet up top, dash up there, and you see a ship burning in the distance, all black as the inside of a cow, and there's this fire. And nothing you can do except just cruise up to your action station. Mine was back on the depth charge, just back aft. And I thought, well, I hadn't done 5 months training in Australia to go and watch them throw a depth charge over the side. I should be up on the ASDIC. But I wasn't. And so we did that convoy back to Gibraltar. Then we went to the next convoy to Gibraltar. And